Tuesday, May 14th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Harvard out of occupied Palestine is out of Harvard Yard. It was announced early today that this particular encampment would be disbanded peacefully. All right, Harvard did have 11 different U.S. Secretaries of State graduate from its colleges or its graduate school. I understand how they could negotiate a settlement. Congrats, Harvard. You did it through perseverance, through understanding, through open dialogue, and also, and this can't be overstated enough, because the semester was ending. The Rafah operations, those are ongoing, but the summer internships, they ain't going to fill themselves. So over at Princeton, however, the negotiations drag on. It's day 14 of their hunger strike, a grueling ordeal as described by a faculty supporter.
On Friday morning, May 3rd, 18 Princeton University students began a hunger strike. They are eating nothing and drinking water very sparingly. These students' blood pressure have dropped and their bodies have begun to consume their own tissue.
Bodies consuming their own tissues. Oh my God, they're losing weight. This is horrible. He continues.
The university has gone out of its way to make life difficult for these beleaguered, underslept, and already hungry student protesters.
Underslept. You know, in college I underslept. Now, I did not at the time. No, I didn't have the words to ask for a humanitarian intervention. But, you know, as I look back, I would have to regard my all-nighters as something of heroic achievements fueled by 3 a.m. Vivarin and coffee. They were, of course, in solidarity with me not having studied at all before for that anthropology exam, but also in solidarity with people on the other side of the world for whom it was, as they called it in their local Argo, 3 p.m. After a bit more than a week of striking, the Princeton hunger strikers gave up. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of that all wrong. They didn't give up. Let me read from the Daily Princetonian, quote, hunger strikers trade off with new participants after 9 days. So the original hunger strikers got to, I don't know what's the word, hungry. New hunger strikers took their place. So they're the same hunger strike, the same amount. What's important is the same amount of hunger striking is going on. We have a threshold of hunger striking, and that threshold is still being met. Why didn't we think of that during the Ethiopian famine? Get out the old people, bring in the new people. We could still call it a famine. Everyone would be happy with that. On a similar note, I'm currently doing fasting. I only eat between 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. And then after 10 p.m., I swap out with my neighbor, Jay. He doesn't eat until 10 a.m. And I have a roast beef sandwich at about midnight, 1 in the morning. And then at 10 a.m., he swaps back with me. And then I go on to have the lumberjack special with a side of hash browns. I am not, for some reason, losing weight, but I have to believe it's saving some oppressed group of people, maybe the Houthis, maybe the Redwood. I mean, if the lumberjacks have all been called away to cook me breakfast. So you may not believe this, but the suffering and resolve of the Princeton protesters has not brought the administration to its knees. Not yet. In fact, the administration is insisting that the encampment be broken up within 24 hours. And it'll come down to who wants it more. It's good to stay hungry, as the swapped out protesters will surely advise the new hunger strikers as the old ones gnaw on produce. The Princeton administration says that essays on restorative justice are an option to absolve the protesters of any punishment. There is no word if the International Criminal Court is offering such options for Netanyahu or Yahya Sinwar. On the show today, cicadas in the news and on our dinner plates. But first, the world's largest democracy is putting that title into practice. Indian elections take weeks to conduct. On the ballot is the party of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. His party, the BJP, it is indicated in polls, will allow Modi to cruise to a third 5-year term. Now, you will hear many adjectives attached to Modi, adjectives like divisive, but also popular. It is one curious aspect of an election where nearly 500 million people are eligible to vote that both those things can be true. Joining me next is an insightful observer of Indian politics, Sadanand Dumas, who writes the East is East column for the Wall Street Journal. He will discuss the sprawl, cacophony, and contradiction that is Indian politics. Do you know who the most popular world leader is? It is Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, which is good for him since the Indian elections are going on. It is a long process. It is a big country. They go on for weeks. And Modi has delivered economic benefits, well, depending on how you measure them, are just really quite extraordinary. During his rule, or even within the last 5 years, 27.7% of Indians were poor, and now it is 16.4% of Indians who are poor. The IMF has actually even better statistics as far as the reduction of poverty. Modi is a skilled politician, which means that he presses certain levers that we in the West might object to. But like I said, the most popular leader, according to polls, in the world. Well, joining me now is someone I've been reading for a long time. He's an opinion columnist. He writes the East is East column for the Wall Street Journal, and he's a resident fellow at the AIE, and he used to be the New Delhi bureau chief for the Far Eastern Economic Review. Sanandan Dume, welcome to The Gist.
Good to be on the show, Mike.
Well, thank you for coming on. So let us talk about, and I've read you on Modi for a long, long time, but let's just talk about his popularity. What's the key to it? He seems very good. He seems strategic. He seems excellent rhetorically. He seems to understand the Indian public. What else am I missing?
Well, you're right. I mean, he is very popular. You know, Morning Consult has a poll that they do of, you know, across various countries. It's about 24 countries where they look at popularity ratings of various figures. And for a long time now, Modi has been, you know, at the top of that list, you know, coming in with a popularity rating of, you know, roughly around 80%. And we're talking about, this has been going on for years. He's a highly popular figure in Indian politics. And as with any kind of, you know, popular politician in a large country, I think different people probably like him for different things. You have a large number of people associated with the Hindu nationalist movement to which he belongs, who view him as this, you know, transformative figure who has who is playing a pivotal role in uplifting their religion and civilization. Then you have people who admire him for having done a fairly good job in terms of eradicating poverty, or at least extreme poverty, by, for example, streamlining the delivery of government services and welfare payments using technology, using cell phones and bank accounts and digital IDs. So there are people who like him for that. There are people who like him because they think he projects a more muscular and self-confident image of India in the world. Many people like him because he is an exceptionally good orator. His native language is Gujarati, but his speeches in Hindi, which is the language most widely spoken in India, are also exceptionally well delivered. And so he's got, you know, he's a politician who, just purely as a politician, whether you like him or hate him, has an enormous set of skills at his command.
Yeah. So I want to take the economic progress and the Hindu nationalism piece by piece. But first, let's talk about the economic progress. Some of the charts, maybe I could compel listeners to go and look at some charts that were put out by Brookings, a fall off the cliff in the number of people who are experiencing extreme poverty, starting from, you know, 1972, where they start having statistics, till now. It's a 90% reduction. It's real. What about the average? What about other measures of economic success? Is the average Indian feeling much better off, much more flush, or that the world is full of possibilities at this point in his tenure versus when he started?
So, you know, just to start, let me just put this in perspective, right? in absolute terms, certainly compared to the United States or compared to any industrialized country, India remains a very poor place, right? In per capita income in dollar terms is roughly around $2,800 per year. In purchasing power terms, which, you know, takes into account that the fact that a haircut costs a lot less in New Delhi than in New York, it's still only around $10,000 a year, according to the IMF this year.
But they're about as, I think the stat I saw in your writing is an Indian is about 1/30th as rich as an American.
If you look at per capita income in the US, it's about $85,000. That's at market exchange rates. If you looked at it at if you looked at it in purchasing power terms, then it would be more like it would be about 1/9th,
right?
Because the you know the your dollar goes farther in a poorer country.
Yeah, and by the way, what if Americans didn't have access to Indian call centers? Then our purchasing power would be worse off, wouldn't it?
Well, that's a whole different story. Yeah.
Yes.
So in any case, but there has been enormous progress in terms of reducing poverty. Now, for the longest time, between 1947 and 1991, as many of your readers know, India followed a planned economy. It was quasi-socialist. And since then, it embarked upon economic reforms, and the economy has began to improve. In terms of the poverty reduction figures, and I talk about that in my most recent Wall Street Journal column, the UN estimates that over the last 20 years, basically between less than 20 years, between 2005 and 2021, India pulled 415 million people out of poverty, which is a staggering number. The UN estimates that it's about 16.4% of Indians are still in poverty.
Yeah. It's like a United States and three Canadas worth of people.
The World Bank estimates that it's about 12.9% of the population, about 1 in 8. When we're talking here about extreme poverty, right, the World Bank's line is, the poverty line is people living on $2.15 a day or less. So there's been enormous progress in reducing that. There are some economists, as you mentioned, there was a blog post on the Brookings site, who say that it's not even 12.9% extreme poverty has been eliminated. So that is certainly one achievement. It's not only a Modi government achievement. This is something that's basically been going on for the last 30 years in particular, and it's accelerated in particular over the last 20 years. 10 years of that have been Modi. But by the same token, he does get some of the credit because he has been prime minister for the last 10 years. And he has targeted some of these, you know, some of the efficient welfare delivery targeting has accelerated the process again. Economic growth has been fairly robust also. So, yeah, I mean, I'd say it's an Indian achievement, but it is also, at least over the last 10 years, a Modi achievement.
And the median Indian, has his or her life improved appreciably?
So I think you've sort of reduced extreme want. So that's, you know, that's one big thing. I think that, yes, I mean, the median Indian is much more likely now to own a television, for example, to own a refrigerator, to have some form of motorized transport, perhaps a motor scooter. More people are buying cars than before. So, you know, it's a democracy and people are always, you know, people always expect more. But I think it's uncontestable that the median Indian in 2024 is better off than the median Indian was in 2014 when Modi took office.
Yes. Now, I know a few years ago, his big initiative was tax reform. And this was a heavy lift because not only were people used to having large piles of cash, they were very used to, and I guess on an individual, though not collective level, enjoyed not paying their taxes. How successful and important a program was this?
Well, there are two different things, right? One was he did what I call nutty demonetization, which is really one of the, you know, the biggest black mark, in fact, on his record, where basically he took advice from some set of cranks and decided overnight to nuke 86% of India's currency. That was not a success by any measure. That was a disaster. There was another tax reform that was undertaken around the same time that has been much more successful, which was something called the Goods and Services Tax, where they took a whole bunch of different taxes, basically, and they tried. They took about four. There were about 400 different taxes, and they kind of distilled it and they made it about 40. I would argue, and many economists have argued, that the Indian Goods and Services Tax is still way too complex. It's the most complex such tax in the world. It has too many slabs. The rates are still too high. But again, if you're comparing it with what existed before it, it's certainly a step in the right direction.
I always hear talk of slabs. Is that what we call brackets?
Yes, that's what you call brackets.
Yes,
exactly. So basically, I would argue that the GST, there's room for improvement, but you could legitimately say that that has broadly been a successful tax reform. The other effort, which was targeted at what Indians call black money, which is money which was not taxed, the demonetization, was an utter and complete disaster.
Interesting. Let's get to the Hindu nationalist charge or description. Would he rebut that, his supporters?
Oh, well, he wouldn't rebut it at all. But I mean, he would. But he tends to sort of, at least when asked about it by the international media, handle it with a certain amount of sophistry. For example, he was asked that in the run up to the election in 2014, like, are you a Hindu nationalist? And he said, well, yes, I'm a Hindu and I'm a nationalist. But obviously, that's not what being a Hindu nationalist means. I don't think that they would, any reasonable person would rebut it. I think what some of his supporters, they resent the term because they see the term as uncomplimentary. Mm-hmm. I view it purely as purely descriptive. Mm-hmm. It describes people who have a particular view of history and a particular view of the centrality of the Hindus, who are the largest religious group in India, to the country. And so I think undoubtedly he is not just a Hindu nationalist, but the most important Hindu nationalist easily in the history of the movement, or certainly in the history of the of Indian politics.
India is necessarily a pluralistic country. It has so many different kinds of people. And how many official languages do you know off the top of your head, for instance?
Too many to count. I think yes. If you pull out an Indian currency bill from my wallet, but it's more than a dozen.
Yes.
And those are just official languages. And then there are hundreds of dialects.
So it, like I said, has to have coexistence codified and constitutionally. But what is the experience or maybe the ideal of the Indian person, or I don't know, maybe the Indian elite when it comes to explicit embrace of Hindu nationalism? So as you know, in the United States, we shall establish no religion. There is a debate about whether it's a Christian nation, and a prayer is often said before the start of a congressional session. Yet at the same time, if a president were running explicitly and as a Christian nationalist and not just vaguely invoking scripture, but doing it to the extent that, say, Modi did, I think that the American intellectual elites or the people who define and say what America is supposed to be would object to that. What about in India? What is the case with how he portrays and acts his Hindu nationalism in the country of India and how that's perceived?
So, there is no one unified view of the elite, right? What basically you have is you have an old elite and they've been replaced by the current elite or the current people who are in power. The old elite would most certainly have disapproved of public displays of religiosity of the type that Mr. Modi is associated with. But the real kind of dividing line between what I would call traditional Indian nationalists and Hindu nationalists has to do with the role of religious minorities, particularly Muslims and Christians in the country. And so if I had to kind of quickly encapsulate that for your listeners, it would basically, there are two competing ideas. One is the idea that was put forward by Gandhi and India's first Prime Minister Nehru, who basically argued that it didn't matter what your religion was, there you could be Hindu or Muslim or Christian or Sikh or whatever, But as long as you were Indian, you were united together in the shared quest to end colonialism and kick out the British. There was this other idea that arose, particularly in the 1930s, which was the idea of the Muslim League, which basically said, no, wait a minute, we're different, we're Muslims, we don't want to live with you guys, we don't, certainly don't want to be live in a country that is dominated by Hindus. And they set out to carve out their own country. They were successful. That country ended up being Pakistan. Now, there was a third stream, the Hindu nationalists, who at the time were not that important, but who are now dominant in Indian politics. And in many ways, their view mirrored the view of the Muslim League, except that they said that, well, yes, it's true, we really are different, but what India is not this multicultural, multi-faith country where we're all kind of, but it's an essentially Hindu nation. There's a particular history where the Hindus have been subjugated by Muslims who came from outside and invaded and conquered the country, and that Indian history has been a long history of struggle to overthrow the foreigner, first the Muslims and then the British. But a traditional Indian nationalist would never make that argument. The argument made by Gandhi and Nehru would be that, well, the British are the problem, they're the foreigners, the Muslims who came to India became fully Indian and are as Indian as anyone else. That's not how the Hindu nationalists see it. That is not how Modi sees it. He explicitly talks about history in a particular way. And that's the dividing line. And the elite are basically, you know, split down the middle.
Yeah.
Where you have the old elite, kind of like, you know, what you saw, say, in a place like Turkey, where you have the, you know, the heirs of Ataturk, who kind of stood for this secularism, tended to be more westernized, tended to speak better English, tended to have, you know, more privilege, stood for the, you know, old style Kemalist secularism. In the Indian case, they stand for old style Nehruvian secularism. And then you have this new rising political movement, which rejects Nehruvian secularism and is very unapologetic about embracing its Hindu identity, including Hindu religiosity, and Modi represents that.
Is Modi clever in that he's, and I'm not saying that it's not sincere, but is he tapping into an extremely popular sentiment, or is his skill in working with that sentiment what makes him so popular?
Both. I mean, he taps into a sentiment that's real, but he also has been able to broaden the appeal of that sentiment and bring many, many more people to his party than had seemed possible before.
Now, as far as, I'll quote from a recent AP article, in recent campaigns, Modi has called Muslims infiltrators and said, quote, they have too many children, referring to a Hindu nationalist trope that Muslims produce more children with the aim of outnumbering Hindus in India. It has also accused the rival, the Indian National Congress Party, of screaming to loot wealth from the country's Hindus. These are words. Either I'd like your opinion of these words, or is the critique of these words a fair critique? And what about his actions, his Hindu nationalist actions?
I think the critique is absolutely a fair critique. I think these are not words that a responsible politician, let alone a prime minister, should be uttering on the campaign trail. I think the BJP calculation is that they are trying to, because of their ideology, they basically have to maximize whatever they can from the 80% of the population that is Hindu, because the 20% of the population that is not Hindu is understandably, not surprisingly, not going to be overly enamored of this, you know, overtly religious party that spends a lot of time talking about and relitigating the past. So what they're trying to do, this is not to defend it in any way, but to explain it. What they're trying to do is to consolidate that 80%, and what he's doing is, I wouldn't even call these dog whistles. You know, they're audible whistles, and he is, you know, trumpeting this in a hope that he can mobilize fearful Hindu voters to flock to his party. That's what's going on over here.
I don't know how the right-left divide would actually work or apply to him as I think of what's going on in the world. But it is often the case that the parties that are most vehement in their rhetoric against minorities within their own country and most forcefully embrace the religious identity of a country are far-right parties. And I wonder in Modi's case, I'm not so interested in the label, how much of it do you think is that he's this brilliant rhetorician, he knows with his words that he could signal to the vast majority of Indians that I am of you and I am on your side, and he uses that to institute policy changes that are, you know, for the good of his voters. He actually delivers on his promises and uses the fiery rhetoric to buttress his popularity. And how much of it is this is a warning that he could very easily slip into very dangerous demagoguery?
You know, I don't know if this is, you know, necessarily, I mean, the demagoguery is already there. And yeah, if you, in my view, if you believe as I do that, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, and that responsibility extends to the words that you choose, I think the problem already exists. This is not some hypothetical problem that we're going to, you know, get to in the future. Now, I suppose that if you were a BJP supporter, you could, and you were, and you know, you could sort of try and minimize it by saying something like, well, you know, this is just election rhetoric. All parties say responsible things. Modi really, you know, talks a lot about the Hindu-Muslim issue. The other side talks a lot about caste instead. Everybody's playing identity politics in India. You could make those arguments, yeah. And I've seen them made. My own view is that when you have a country that is, as you said, that is essentially pluralistic, I think it's important for leadership in that country across political parties to, you know, at least play, you know, pay lip service to the ideal of equality. Ideally, they do much more than just pay lip service, but lip service has to be at least a minimum requirement to be a responsible person in public life. And unfortunately, I think this the consensus on this in India seems to have broken down.
Sadanand Dume is the East is East columnist for the Wall Street Journal, a fellow at AEI, a former New Delhi correspondent for the Far East Economic Review. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And now the spiel. The cicadas are emerging, brood 13 and 19, I think they're called. Maybe you say the X's, the XIII. I haven't really consulted the cicadas about their preferred numerical system. But they're both emerging at the same time. And rather than brood on it, the news is covering this with a pun-filled glee.
It's already underway in the South, and this spring, by some estimates, about a trillion cicadas will emerge. And as CBS's Dave Malkoff reports, a lot of people are bugging out.
Obviously, I approve the pun. It just hit a little hard, thus bugging me. You see, don't do that. You just say it and you move on. Now, there's one go-to angle in reporting on the cicada invasion, and that's to concentrate on a certain aspect of these particular arthropods. Here is WBAL's Lisa Robinson.
On to the cicada fry.
We have some sauces to dip them in, some honey mustard, sriracha.
Michael Eversmeyer is a naturalist at the Nature Center. He's our chef today.
Yes, cicadas are edible. That was a fact explored at length in an interview on NPR between host Leila Fadel and cicada chef Joseph Yoon. I have some comments. Let's join the two mid-interview as the proprietor of Brooklyn Bugs, Joseph Yoon, explains where cicadas get their flavor.
They've been living underground, slowly feasting on plant and tree xylem for 13 or 17 years.
Oh, tree xylem. See, I didn't realize that. They must be delicious.
And so they have this really beautiful vegetal quality and a nutty quality as well.
I'll tell you someone else who has kind of a nutty quality.
And so when you deep fry them, they're just like so delicious and so special. Really, a big part of cooking with insects and cicadas really lies with our imagination.
Right. trying to imagine they're not crawling on your skin or flying into your eye.
And thinking about how can we add these arthropods.
But it's a delicacy in some places, right?
It is indeed a delicacy in many areas.
You know, I've always wondered about delicacies. Delicacy, it's always a word for a disgusting thing or something disgusting to us that other people, smarter and more sophisticated than us, know to eat. Offal, sweetbreads, these are all described as delicacies. How about, what's an American delicacy? How about Fruit Brute? Of the monster cereals, that is the most rare, or the mango gummy bear. They're out there. I mean, you can find them. They're just not standard. I don't know. Maybe to someone in Indonesia, they think, mango gummy bear. Blah. Anyway, Chef Yoon, who knows from yuck as a reaction, Chef Yoon goes on.
There may be regions around the world that can forage and collect insects for human consumption. But when we're really talking about food security, we're talking about the rearing and husbandry, the farming of insects on mass scale to be able to produce and then to be able to utilize.
Did you hear the inaccuracy in there? The thing that was incorrect? It went by quickly. I caught it. Let me just play it for you so you could hear it in the clear.
The farming of insects on mass.
There it was. It was the We're talking about eating insects. We rate that 4 Pinocchios and 3 Jiminy Crickets. Yoon continued, distracting the NPR audience from the fact that he was talking about eating bugs by leaning into their love language, which is sustainability.
And the reason why it's so sustainable is that it takes far less resources by way of the amount of water, the feed, the land, and it creates far less greenhouse gas emissions than the counterpart livestock that we're traditionally using today.
Now, I should say this guest, Joseph Yoon, I first encountered him not during this interview, but in a podcast by John Ronson, a BBC podcast called Things Fall Apart. And in it, Yoon was one of a couple of figures. Another was a Norwegian cabinet minister. Another was an Englishman keen on bus lanes. And their public pronouncements gave inspiration to a massive conspiracy theory called the Great Reset. And the Great Reset sought to convince, and did so to great effect, that the world elites were seeking to subjugate the masses, strip them of possessions, and yes, force them to eat bugs. In fact, Tucker Carlson, would you believe he was a believer in this big conspiracy theory? He produced a documentary when he was at Fox called Let Them Eat Bugs. And Joseph Yoon was a main character. But it seems to me that one way to disabuse people who are worried about the Great Reset, about being forced to eat bugs, would be to show that there's nothing forceful about it, that bugs are simply delicious. They're not terrible to eat. And that would not only combat disinformation, I would say eating the bugs is a basic requirement if you're going to do a fun, quirky segment on a chef who prepares bugs. I say rule of journalism, rule of TV journalism, rule of broadcast journalism. By the end of that segment on eating bugs, you gotta eat the bugs. It's great TV. Remember Lisa Robinson of Baltimore, who we played up top? Here's how she ended her WBAL segment.
Taking one for the team.
No, you eat it, Steve.
Lisa Robinson, WBAL, TV 11 News.
You're a good sport, Lisa.
Great sport, huh?
Gosh.
And even Tucker Carlson, before he made Yoon out to be a loon in his documentary, had Yoon on for an on-set segment. And guess what? Tucker Carlson, conspiracist Tucker Carlson, guess what he gleefully did?
I'm gonna smell it, and then I'm just gonna nibble on it.
You know what? If eating together kind of helps.
You know what? I trust you so much.
Forget the morning time.
You're the first bug chef I've ever met. I'm just going to go ahead and do it.
Thank you. Yeah. Bug appetit.
Tucker, for all his flaws, understands good TV. And good TV, good broadcasting of all time, dictates you got to eat the bug. Well, let's rejoin the NPR interview. In this part, Yoon talks about how with the right preparation, sauces, and deep frying, even a bug can be made somewhat irrelevant in the overall dish and therefore plausibly delicious.
Do you have some favorite recipes?
my all-time favorite recipe utilizing the adult cicadas is a tempura fried cicada.
Mm.
And there you heard it again, another quite deceitful mmm. But what you didn't hear was the basic requirement of any segment on eating bugs. No, the host did not eat the bug. That, as I've said before, you've heard me say it, you gotta eat the bug. It is a huge missed opportunity, NPR, not to eat the bug. Now, I have been talking about NPR's falling listenership for some time, and this is a prime example. If the host is not going to eat the bug, how can you trust the host? Tucker ate the bug, and his audience followed him to the ends of the earth and beyond, way beyond. I'm not serious about this. Not eating the bug, I don't think, has a discernible effect on listenership. I don't think focus groups will say, what we want more of is Steve Inskeep eating bugs. But all of what it was a possibly fun segment turned into a much less fun segment, a lesson on sustainability, environmentalism, and a little bit of tempura, which, you know, it would all go down easier if you just ate the damn thing, sort of like a bug in batter, deep fried, and covered in hot sauce. And then the listener will say, That's it for today's show. Corey Warr is the producer, Joel Patterson's the senior producer, and Michelle Pesca holds the position of being in charge of special projects. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umperu, Jeeperu, Dooperu. Thank you for listening.